This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The COVID pandemic ushered in an era of rising crime in the United States. Homicides are up 40% in major cities, according to the Council on Criminal Justice. And so far this year, robberies are up 19% over 2021, and car thefts up 15%. Well, President Joe Biden has unveiled a new $37 billion plan to tackle crime nationwide. He introduced the so-called Safer America Plan in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, last month.
You know, peace of mind knowing your kids can go to school or the playground or the movies or the high school game and come home safely, not have to think about it. But for too long, too many families haven't had that peace of mind. They watch the news and they see kids being gunned down in schools and on the streets. Almost every single night you turn the news on, that's what you see. They see their neighbors lose their loved ones to drugs like fentanyl, which is a flat killer. They see hate and anger and violence just walking the streets of America. And they just want to feel safe again. They want to feel a sense of security. And that's what my crime plan is all about.
Biden's anti-crime proposal is a big, broad-spectrum plan that includes most of the things crime experts have long called for. And it's also about politics, a pushback against Republicans' branding of Democrats as the Defund the Police Party. But we want to dig into the details of the plan today, figure out what's in it, and what will or won't work to effectively reduce crime in the United States. Well, joining me now is Richard Rosenfeld. He's Emeritus Professor of Criminology at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He's authored reports for the Council on Criminal Justice on crime trends since the height of the pandemic. And he's also co-author of what's been described as one of the seminal works in criminological theory. It's called Crime and the American Dream. Professor Rosenfeld, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So start with your top line assessment of the Biden Safer America plan. I should say it's not just one standalone bill, is it, right?
It's certainly not. What it most immediately reminds me of is the 1994 crime bill passed during the Clinton administration, also following a major uptick in crime in the United States. And of course, President Biden, then Senator Biden, contributed to the crime bill. This one is just as broad, just as multifaceted as the one passed in 94.
Well, so I would say President Biden probably doesn't want to have those be the connections that are made, because the 1994 crime bill is looked upon as one of the key things that accelerated mass incarceration in this country.
It is, though I think by and large, that's a mistaken view. Mass incarceration shortly after 94 began to flatten and then come down. Much of the crime bill's emphasis on incarceration was simply, in effect, restating what most states were already doing. So we could talk endlessly about the impact of the 94 crime bill on incarceration. Let me just simply say that there was much more to the crime bill than incarceration. Its impact on incarceration, I think, has been exaggerated.
Okay, well, you're right. We could go over the 94 crime bill for quite some time, but let's move forward to what's happening today. I guess the point that you're making is this is a large plan that could potentially, if passed, have quite a significant impact. The question is, what impact would it have?
Right.
And again, I want to just emphasize, this is not a single, you know, the Safer America plan, as Biden calls it, it's not a single piece of legislation. It's a bunch of different legislative proposals that include things like crime prevention strategies, $20 billion for housing, mental health, and alternate responders rather than police officers to address causes of crime that are not violent crime. There's some gun reform in there, which we'll talk about, police training, drug treatment. What do you think are the, or drug courts, I should say, the expansion of drug courts. So, Professor Rosenfeld, what do you think are the pieces of this overall plan that could potentially be most effective?
Well, and I know this is something we're going to discuss at some length later in the program, but the addition of 100,000 police officers, in my view, can help to reduce crime. I think the community crime prevention provisions that we'll also discuss can be quite effective, though not all of those community-based prevention programs are likely to be equally effective. And then, as you mentioned, there are provisions in this plan to expand background checks on all gun sales with very limited exceptions, to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, to enhance background checks for purchasers under the age of 21. So this is a soup to nuts bill, and as we move through our discussion, we can discuss some of its other details.
Mm. Do you think that let's imagine for a moment that the plan and its various parts do actually make it through the legislative process.
Right.
If put together, will they produce the desired effect of reducing crime rates in this country?
Well, that very much depends on how the plan is implemented. As you mentioned, it's unlikely that all facets of this plan will make it through Congress. I think we'll have a better sense of that after the midterm elections. The old saying, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's going to depend on how the plan is implemented locally. One of the things I like about this plan is that it sets out some pretty clear guidelines about how local agencies can obtain these funds. The funds aren't simply going to be delivered to them automatically. They're going to have to apply for them. And for example, with respect to hiring more police officers, the agencies will have to demonstrate that those officers will in fact be out on patrol, not simply sitting behind a desk. They'll be trained in so-called community policing and also de-escalation techniques. And so the plan contains requirements for how the money should be used. And we'll just have to see the degree to which those requirements make it into practice.
Mm. But does the Safer America plan, perhaps in its size, that $37 billion and the variety of programs that it entails, does it have a feel of like just throwing the spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks in terms of effectively reducing crime?
Yes, it does. I'm not sure spaghetti on the wall is the correct analogy, but there's a lot, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, there's just a lot in here that is clearly intended to appeal to multiple constituencies with respect to crime reduction. So just as examples, there's provision in the plan for more summer jobs for teenagers. There's provision in the plan for improvements to the physical environment that might reduce crime, such as better street lighting. There's over $5 billion in the plan for several types of community-based programs, one of which is called Focus Deterrence, and I'd like to talk about that in just a moment. Another is for hiring and training more so-called violence interrupters, and we can talk about that one. There's provision in the plan for hospital-based anti-violence programs. There are provisions for lifting restrictions on access to federal benefits and programs for formerly incarcerated persons. There's a provision to repeal mandatory minimums for nonviolent crimes. There's a provision to ban so-called ghost guns. Just this list of details suggests the breadth of this program. And I think it's, you know, one could make the case that a somewhat more narrowly focused set of proposals that narrowly focused on strategies and policies that the evidence indicates are very likely to reduce crime, That argument, I think, bears mentioning. But that's not the plan we have before us and we're discussing this morning.
Well, as you noted, we will get into further details about things like focused deterrence, because I'd love to understand better what that is. But, you know, this plan comes at a very particular time. As I mentioned at the top of the show, there's been a significant increase in crime rates across the country in the past couple of years. Do you think that the plan would address the core causes, the core factors of that that rising rate? And if so, what are those core factors at play right now?
Yeah, good point. Let's start though with an assessment of what's actually happened to crime rates over the last couple of years. Homicide rates rose by approximately 30% across the country in 2020 during the height of the pandemic. In many of the cities that I've looked at as part of the Council on Criminal Justice's series of reports on crime trends, it turns out that in many cities, those increases began to occur almost immediately after the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis and widespread protest demonstrations emerged across the country. So we're beginning to look now at some of the factors associated with the rise.
Well, Professor Rosenfeld, hang on here for just a second, because we do have to take a quick break. When we come back from it, I'll let you finish your thought about what's driving the current rise in crime rate. We're also going to really focus on what's the most controversial part of President Biden's Safer America plan, that $13 billion that would be dedicated to hiring 100,000 more police officers across the country. We'll tackle that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about President Joe Biden's recently announced so-called Safer America plan. It's a $37 billion suite of proposals designed to fight crime, to reduce rising crime rates in this country. So we're talking about what's actually in the proposals and whether or not they would be effective. I'm joined today by Richard Rosenfeld. He's Emeritus Professor of Criminology at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, and it's in its fifth edition now. And Professor Rosenfeld, before the break, you were describing sort of the drivers of the current rise in crime rates across the country and whether or not what's in the so-called Safer America plan would actually address those driving factors. And I just wanted to let you finish your thought.
Yeah, thank you. Well, in fact, crime rates during the height of the pandemic, overall crime rates, including the rates of serious crime, came down. The large exception was the increase in homicide we saw. And of course, that's a very important exception. And there was an increase in non-fatal gun-related crime. But overall crime rates came down. Larceny rates, which are by far the larceny is by far the most voluminous of serious crimes, they dropped during the pandemic. A big chunk of larceny is shoplifting, and when the shops are closed, there's no shoplifting. So that's one point I'd like to make, that overall crime rates came down, homicide being an obviously important exception. Since the height of the pandemic, what we've seen is in 21, a continuing rise in homicide, though at a slower pace. Homicides went up 5% in 21 compared to the year before. And so far this year, at least through the end of June, we've seen overall homicide rates in the cities that we look at in the Council on Criminal Justice reports flatten and even come down a bit. Other researchers have found the same thing. So we're seeing some flattening in homicide, though we still have a long way to go to bring homicide levels back to where they were before the pandemic.
Well, so does that mean that Americans have a really misconstrued notion of how much crime is actually happening in this country? I mean, President Biden even, you know, he in that statement that I played earlier at the top of the show, you know, he talked about Americans seeing hate and anger and violence just walking the streets of America. But then he also said they watch the news and they see kids being gunned down in schools and on the streets. So is there a misunderstanding right now of what's actually going on?
I think to some degree, yes. But in other ways, I think Americans are correct in their observation that crime rates are emerging. Let's go back to the Biden plan for a moment. There's only literally just a few sentences directed at crimes other than violent crime. Now, violent crime is obviously our most important crime problem, but we've got other crime problems as well. And so the plan directs very limited attention to what we're seeing now, and you referenced in the opening to the program, a large rise in street robberies and a very large rise in larcenies. And as I said earlier, a big chunk of larceny is shoplifting. Mm-hmm. Larcenies are thefts that occur without force, without breaking and entering, such as a burglary. They are very, very widespread. Americans are much more likely to be touched by a larceny or know someone who has than to be touched by a homicide. So in that sense, I think America's sense that crime rates are rising, I think, is quite correct when we think about these nonviolent, but also, I would argue, quite serious crimes. And I wish the crime plan that the president has put forward devoted more attention to responses that would help curb the rise in property crimes.
Okay. Well, what it does devote attention to, and a third of the funding for the plan would go to this, is the proposal to hire 100,000 more police officers in this country. So again, the plan's $37 billion overall. $13 billion would go to the hiring for more officers. So here is what President Joe Biden said a couple of weeks ago when he first unveiled, again, the so-called Safer America plan.
When it comes to public safety in this nation, the answer is not defund the police. It's fund the police. Fund the police. And give them, we expect them to do everything. We expect them to be, to protect us, to be psychologists, and to be sociologists. I mean, we expect you to do everything. I'm not joking. Everything. You realize more police officers are killed dealing with domestic violence than anything else? You realize that? The point is, we ask so much of you, so much of you.
President Joe Biden, a couple of weeks ago in Pennsylvania there. Well, joining me now is Eli Mistal. He's justice correspondent for The Nation and author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Eli Mistal, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm well. Okay. So let's talk about this 100,000 new police officers notion. Do you think it will have an impact in the neighborhoods that need it the most, particularly the neighborhoods that have seen, for example, the sharp rise in homicides over the past few years?
Sure, it'll have an impact if what you want is more dead black people. I honestly cannot believe that we are back here talking about the failed programs of the 90s here in the 2020s. 100,000 new cops will have a statistically provable effect on this country. That effect will be to lead to more dead black people, more harassed black people, and more constitutionally violated black people, because that's what cops do. That's what the studies say cops do. There is no study that shows that a random increase in funding of more police leads to a reduction of crime. But there is evidence that increasing the police force leads to the increasing danger towards unarmed, innocent, non-criminal Black citizens. To say nothing of the fact that there is very inconclusive evidence about whether actual boots on the ground, actual cops on the street, actually work to prevent crime. Some studies say there is some effect. Some studies say there is no effect. But you know what, again, the studies tend to agree with? That the police aren't really there to stop crime. They're there to arrest people after they've committed the crime. And if you don't believe me, just look at Uvalde. Where we had, I don't know how many cops standing outside while crime was happening inside a school doing nothing. That's what police do. And so the idea that, Professor Rosenthal made a really good point, that this is not just one plan. This is a bunch of plans. This is a bunch of different proposals. There's not one line in this plan, not one stitch in this plan about police accountability. And I'm sorry if I'm a bit heated, but it offends me that the president, who is in office in part on the backs of a summer of sweaty protests, of dangerous protests, where Black people put their bodies on the line to protest police brutality. It offends me that this president, who was in office in part because of that, is now out here with a plan that says not one line about police accountability or police punishment when they inevitably kill the Black people that we know they will, based on historical evidence.
Hmm. First of all, Ellie, there's never a need to apologize for impassioned reasoning. So just no apologies necessary here. But let me go back to something that you said earlier. You said you can't believe we're in 2022. We're back in 1994, essentially. So why do you think that the push for hiring more police officers is going on right now, and that Joe Biden is very vocally advocating for it?
Because it's all centrist Democrats can think about. It's all centrist liberals can think about. They are willing, and this is what this plan is. They are willing to sacrifice Black bodies for the appearance of safety for whites. Again, not actual safety. We're not actually doing things that are going to make us more safe. We're trying to get to the appearance of increased safety. That's what cops do. You see them on the street, it looks like it's safer when you see cops in riot gear protecting your target. It's not safer. You're not actually doing anything to stop crime. And look, Biden said it himself. A lot of cops are killed during domestic violence disputes. Do you want to decrease the danger of domestic violence situations? Well, you got to take away the guns. Cops aren't going to do that. That's not why you hire 100,000 more cops. That's why you pass handgun bans, for instance. And Professor's right. There is stuff in this about, we should totally, it's a call, right? It's a suggestion. We should totally have laws that ban assault weapons. That's great. You know what the Supreme Court is going to do to that law? Say no. So the thing that Biden can do is hire more cops. The thing that he can't do because the Supreme Court won't let him is the actual thing that would help, which is take guns off the street. Mm. So instead of kind of wrestling with that reality, that the thing that we need to do to prevent crime is to reform and rebalance the extremist Supreme Court that will not let us have safe gun laws, instead of focusing on that problem, he throws 100,000 more cops at the problem, knowing that it won't help, knowing that it will lead to more Black and brown death, but hoping that it will appease white moderates and independents for the midterms. Yeah. That's the calculus here, and it's gross to me.
I hear you on that. And at the same time, I'm thinking about the true urgency in some cities in particular in this country right now. It wasn't that long ago that we took a close look at Philadelphia that's had this massive spike, more than 500 homicides. And almost all of the victims of those homicides in just the past year are Black. Those two are Black deaths as a result of crime. And it's so bad in Philly that, you know, at least for a moment there, Black representatives of the city were themselves wondering, should they bring back Stop and Frisk? Because they need to do something right now to reduce the amount of crime that is hurting Black people in the city. So
again, but look at look at what they're saying there. Like the idea here is that if you were just willing to be hardcore, if you were just willing to be politically incorrect and, you know, put boots on the ground, let the cops bash some skulls in, reinstitute racial profiling and stop and frisk, that we need to do something right now to prevent crime. And my point here with that logic is that it doesn't work. I'm not saying that I'm too much of a knee-jerk, heart-bleeding liberal to be unwilling to make tough choices. I'm saying I'm only willing to make tough choices that work. Mm. Stop and frisk doesn't work. More cops doesn't work. More funding doesn't work. We absolutely need to address the crime problem in some places that we already know are over-policed. We have places that are over-policed and still dealing with high incidence of crime. That suggests that the policing doesn't work.
Yeah.
We need actual solutions that will work. And again, one of those solutions is taking away the guns.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways to, you know, countries that have low gun violence are the countries that have low gun ownership. So if we actually address the elephant in the room, the guns, that would work. We don't want to address the elephant in the room. We feel like we can't address the elephant in the room. We feel like addressing the elephant in the room would scare off independent hunters who just want to go out and shoot Bambi's mom. And what's wrong with that? And so instead of addressing the actual problem, we do something that will not help, that will not work, that will lead to more unarmed Black and brown deaths, and call it a day.
Mm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Well, let me turn back to Professor Rosenfeld here, because I want to hear from you, Professor, on whether what the evidence is, either supporting or disproving the idea that putting more police officers on the streets actually does reduce violent crime, especially because I'm looking at a couple of sets of data that would comport with what Elie Mystal is saying, that first of all, we have, in terms of crimes that have already been committed, an extraordinarily low clearance rate in some cities in terms of solving those crimes, those homicides especially. And in addition, if I understand correctly, except until recently, the 2020-2021 period, violent crime had been steadily going down in the United States, even as the number of per capita police officers in this country remained relatively steady. Is that not true, Professor Rosenfeld?
That is true. And the larger point is that the number of police officers by itself isn't the sole determinant of the crime rate. There's no question about that. I think the more immediate question, though, and where I would take issue with what we just heard, is whether the addition of police officers during the 1990s, after the crime bill was passed, had any measurable impact on crime rates. And in fact, the weight of the evidence suggests that it did. Those crime reductions that have been associated with turned out to be about 85,000 more police officers furnished by the crime bill. The impact was modest, but it was discernible. So the idea that adding more police officers will not reduce or never can reduce crime, I think, is incorrect. But it really depends on what the officers do. If the officers are hired and sit behind a desk, that's going to have little to no impact on crime. If the officers are hired and if they're well trained, and we could talk about what that amounts to, yes, it can have a measurable impact on crime. The weight of the evidence suggests that when police officers engage in highly tailored prevention activities in those communities that are experiencing the highest rates of crime, that strategy does tend to reduce crime. And the evidence, in fact, nothing about policing has generated more positive evidence than that so-called tailored approach. It used to be called so-called hotspot policing, whatever one calls it. It tends to be effective. So, I take issue with the idea that the police have little or nothing to do with crime. I certainly am sympathetic to the notion that there are far too many unwarranted incidents of police violence in the United States. But the solution is not to abandon the police, nor is the solution abandon communities, remove police officers from communities who desperately want them and want them to be effective and fair.
Professor Rosenfeld, hang on, and Ellie Mistala will definitely let you get another word in here as soon as we come back from the other side of this quick minute break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm joined today by Richard Rosenfeld. He's Emeritus Professor of Criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And Ellie Mistal is with us as well. He's Justice Correspondent for The Nation. And Ellie, I know you wanted to respond to what Professor Rosenfeld was saying.
Yeah, so I didn't say abandon police. And just to bring people back, like the last thing that was said was that, yes, we know that there are way too many unfortunate incidences of police violence, but that's not a reason to abandon police. And I want to, first of all, stay for a second on the but, right? Because it's not an acceptable answer that there's way too many incidents of police violence against Black folks, but we're not going to do anything about that, or we're not going to care about that, or we're not going to make new laws and new restrictions to keep them from being violent, even as we're talking about hiring more of them. That's just not an acceptable answer. But I'm not saying that the response is to abandon police. The response is to hold police accountable when they commit crimes and understand the limits of what police can do. And if you are worried about crime, understand that throwing 100,000 more boots on the ground is not a solution. One of the analogies that I like to make here is like, I'm a dog lover, right? If I get a new dog, I also get a new leash. It's not because I don't like the dog. It's not because I'm not going to train the dog. It's not because I'm going to take care of the dog. It's because I need to make sure that I have control over the dog so it doesn't hurt other people. Now, why can't we apply the same idea to the police? The police, yes, sometimes they help. Sometimes they're lovable. Sometimes they get your cat out of the tree. But sometimes they hurt people.
Yeah.
Sometimes they hurt the wrong people. And when they're hurt people who are unarmed, who are children, there needs to be accountability for those actions, and there's not in this country. And so we cannot move forward into some kind of world where the police are the lovable heroes of your childhood cartoons without addressing the fact that they ruin lives and are not held accountable for those deaths.
Yeah, so Ellie, you're exactly right to say that you did not say abandon the police. But in fairness, I did not hear Professor Rosenfeld also say that nothing should be done about police violence. So I just want to be clear on that. But this question of accountability is actually something that President Biden sort of somewhat addressed in a little bit of sort of a politically vague term. But here he is saying that not only does he want his plan to end up being a tool by which more police officers are hired, but that they should be trained better.
That's why my crime plan to help communities recruit, hire, and train nationwide more than 100,000 additional officers, accountable officers, for community policing. And I mean it. Folks, when it comes to fighting crime, we know it works. Officers on the street who know the neighborhood, not a joke, who know the neighborhood, who know the families they're protecting, who get the training they need to be able to do their jobs well, who work to earn the community's trust.
Now, Professor Rosenfeld, I don't actually see two things. I don't actually see any sort of significant reform of, say, qualified immunity in Biden's Safe for America plan. So that would be a major way to get more accountability into American policing. And second of all, you talked about training as well. Has there been a significant advancement in police training over, say, the past 10 years? Because, you know, we've heard a lot about officer training programs using like warrior mentality curricula, such that we have young officers coming out of police academies and going into the communities they serve, having been trained to see everyone in that community as a potential enemy. I don't see, has training changed all that much from that?
I don't think training has changed fundamentally. There has been a movement in recent years to expand training and to de-emphasize the warrior mentality that you mentioned. Let me also say that and I wish there was more attention devoted to accountability. I quite agree on that one. But there is a provision in the Biden plan to restrict, not eliminate, but restrict no-knock warrants. There's a provision to expand the use of body cameras so that, for example, whenever an officer's on patrol, the body camera would have to be turned on. So these don't go to the, if you will, the legal issue of accountability, but I do think they are welcome steps forward. Let me say one other thing about this whole idea of it's not abandoned. It is abandoning the police, and I did say that. But it's really abandoning communities. I think, for all of us, it's useful to remind ourselves what Jim Crow policing was all about. Policing during the Jim Crow era in the United States. That was a period of, by and large, under, not over policing, but under policing of Black communities, leaving those communities to fend for themselves. And then there were always episodes of egregious, brutal over policing. But the general approach was to keep the police out of those communities. We used racial segregation as the crime control device. In those days, we never, ever want to return to that period where we abandon communities, remove the police, and let them deal with crime on their own.
Wouldn't a better
Elijah
way?
Elijah McClain was walking home in his own community, walking back in his own community home when he was stopped, harassed, brutalized, and eventually died at the hands of police officers who were not held accountable. That is what policing in the communities also looks like. And until we address that problem, we can't have all the good stuff that people want. I'm sorry to be like the bearer of bad news, but when you have a community policing without account, see, we're talking about training, but when you have training without accountability, when you have community policing without accountability, when you tell these cops, like, okay, here's what you're supposed to put your body cameras on, but there's no punishment when they don't. There's no strict liability. Your body camera went off, you go to jail for a year. Because now everything you say, we don't believe. When there's no actual accountability, when these cops violate the standards and practices that they're supposed to operate under, then we can't have the nice things that other people want.
That's a fair point.
Professor Rosenfeld, I also want to ask another thing, because when you said we don't want to go back to Jim Crow policing.
Right.
Because in part that was an era in which the police abandoned those communities. But wasn't the real problem Jim Crow? I mean,
absolutely.
Right? So I don't say that to be facetious. I seriously am asking, in that case, isn't the way to reduce crime to invest in communities, not just to invest in policing? But here we have a proposal from the Biden administration, or a suite of proposals, that's willing to invest millions, if not billions of dollars, say, in additional education for police. Why not take some of those funds and invest them in the communities in different ways, such that, you know, the fundamental drivers of crime, as you were talking about, by the way, including racism, we can do something practical about.
Absolutely. And you're right. This is not a bill that directs significant funding to those conditions in our society that have generated and sustained over the long term high rates of violent crime, and indeed high rates of all types of crime. That's not what this bill is about. And it can be faulted for that. But, you know, as we've said, this bill is about a lot of other things as well. But the bill is primarily directed at bringing down or curbing the increases in violent crime in particular we've seen over the last couple of years. Other legislation is badly needed to address the long-term drivers of crime, to reduce chronic joblessness, to improve job training, to raise wages. Those are the kinds of changes ultimately that will bring down our horrendously high, by comparative standards, violent crime rates. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is trying to provide means by which this recent increase can be curbed.
Mm. Elie Mystal, we've really rightly focused on the increasing the number of police officers portion of the bill, because, again, that's a third of this $37 billion. And I know you probably have more to say about that, but I also just did want to take a second to ask you what you thought of the other two-thirds, right, of the plan, which includes $20 billion for housing, mental health, alternate responders, as I mentioned earlier with Professor Rosenfeld, some gun law reform, background checks, an attempt to once again get an assault weapons ban through, funding for de-escalation training for police. And then, you know, I talked momentarily about expansion of drug courts and funneling people through, you know, more humane system of rehabilitation rather than incarceration. Certainly those things are worthy of pursuing.
I break those things out. So let's do lightning round. The first thing you said is more money for better housing, better mental health, crime interrupters. All that stuff is great. That stuff would actually work. I'm a fan of it. Yeah, let's go. You mentioned the gun laws, the gun restrictions. As I've said, that is not a bill. That is a hope. And that is a hope that will be crushed by the conservative extremists on the Supreme Court. So when you say, like, oh, we should totally have an assault weapons ban, yeah, great, I agree. Are you going to reform the Supreme Court so that we can have an assault weapons ban? No, because if you're not, then you're just then you're just wish casting. Then you might as well be just singing a Disney song, right? Because, like, it has no impact on reality unless you're going to do something about the Supreme Court. And then finally, and I'm glad you brought this up, because you guys were talking so much about how this bill focuses on violent crime. But, you know, one of the failures of the 1994 crime bill, one of the biggest and most obvious ones, right? One of the most racist ones, was its distinction between the criminal penalties for crack versus powder cocaine, right? Like I'm just going to assume that we've all done the reading and we're all up now on the idea that that disparity was awful, racist, and broke communities. And in fact, in this Safer America plan, Biden purports to make sure that, you know, kind of do away with the last vestiges of that and treat crack and powder cocaine the same. But we've got a new boogeyman drug in this bill, and that is fentanyl. Because for some reason, no matter how far removed we are from these past failures, there's always got to be one bad drug that we put people in jail for. And in this bill, it's fentanyl. So we are going to, speaking of repeating mistakes, we are going to, again, repeat the mistake of over-criminalizing a drug, an addiction, a sickness. We're going to over-criminalize a medical problem and turn that into another excuse to incarcerate people. So again, I think, if we were just focusing on violent crime, I think this bill would be better. But of course, when you look at the larger bill, it's not just focusing on violent crime. It's doing a lot of, again, the same mistakes of the 90s.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. I will briefly say, though, Ellie, that fentanyl is killing people. It's killing thousands of people every year who are overdosing on drugs that they thought were definitely not as powerful. And
I'm not saying fentanyl is good. I wasn't saying that crack is good. Yeah. I'm saying that over-criminalizing these drugs, that are the drugs are bad, criminalizing the people who take them is not the answer.
Well, but the White House would say that the plan is imposing penalties on trafficking, on fentanyl trafficking.
Right, and
sure.
That's what they said.
That's what they said about crack and powder cocaine too.
Professor but Rosenfeld, go ahead. Yeah,
yeah. The gist of the bill's emphasis on fentanyl is to generate laws, and we can discuss whether this is a good idea or not. To crack down on the so-called fentanyl analogs. So, right, there's fentanyl, pure fentanyl, and it's already a Schedule I drug, but producers come up with these analogs that are just as harmful, but technically not illegal or not Schedule I, and the bill would ratchet up penalties for those. Now, the ratcheting up of penalties could well lead to more street dealers being criminalized, and I quite agree. That's not the approach we need to take. I agree that the drug problem is by and large a medical problem. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can fault the bill for kind of willy-nilly criminalizing. What it's trying to do is crack down on these alternative forms of fentanyl that currently are not illegal.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have about a minute left today, and I want to give Ellie Mistal the last word here. Just give me your final thought about what you think the real purpose of Biden introducing this bill right now is, and what you'd like to see instead, Ellie.
As opposed to an actual attempt to address deep problems with crime, gun violence, and what have you, this is an attempt to give cover to moderate centrist Democrats in swing states who need something to run on to say that, oh, they're doing something about crime. And once again, it is a deal that centrist Democrats have made for the past 30 or 40 years. It is offering up cracking the skulls of black and brown people for the appearance of safety to help a political election, as opposed to something like the George Floyd policing bill, which was the thing that was one of the things that helped ride Biden into office. This is what he wants to run on the midterms.
Well, Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation and author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Richard Rosenfeld, emeritus professor of criminology at the University of Missouri-St. Louis and co-author of Crime and the American Dream. Professor Rosenfeld, thank you so very much for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.